As we get older, all of us notice unmistakable signs of aging, that creak in your knee, maybe, or the onset of diabetes. We live in a terror of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, cancer or stroke, and we fear the prospect of the nursing home. In a new book, Dr. Sherwin Nuland, himself a septuagenarian, argues that while death is inevitable, for many people, the quality of our last decades remains within our control, that aging is not a disease in and of itself, but an art. The book is aimed at folks in their 50s and 60s, so we ask you, boomers, is aging a sentence or an opportunity? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Later this hour, New Age gossip comes to the nation's capital. But first, Sherwin Nuland joins us from our bureau in Chicago. He's professor of surgery at Yale University Medical School and the author of How We Die and, most recently, The Art of Aging. It's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
You write in this book, many are the ways of not giving in to old age, and they range from the pitiably ridiculous to the healthfully sublime. And you give us plenty of examples of both.
Well, I'm more interested, of course, in the healthfully sublime.
I'm a journalist. I'm more interested in the pitiably ridiculous.
Well, there we are. That's the difference between a doc and a surgeon. My sense, and this is the reason I use the word art, my sense is that it can be an art. We argue back and forth about what is meant by art, and no one seems to agree. But there are two factors that do seem to be important to all of us, and that is that art must be something that's enriching. Art must be something that's creative. And I have felt, as I have watched people when I was in my 30s and 40s who've gotten older and then myself gotten into my 50s, 60s, and now 70s, that, my God, these can be the most enriching years of life. We can rediscover ourselves as we get older.
And the critical point you make over and over and over again, aging is not a disease.
Aging is not a disease. Aging is, of course, a perfectly normal physiological process. It is a stage of life. It certainly predisposes us more likely to diseases like malignancies or strokes or heart attacks or dementias. But those are pathological. And one of the things that I tried to point out in the book, in fact, one whole chapter is devoted to it, is what are the differences between normal aging and those things that require some medical attention, because most people don't really understand the differences.
So just if you're starting to feel, a particular creak or groan in one of your joints, this is not to say you should accept this as normal. On the other hand, maybe this is something that is, this is part of the package if you're 70 years old now.
Well, one of the questions I'm asked most often is, what about short-term memory? What about the fact that I can't remember people's names? And, of course, it's very important to reassure people that these are simply ordinary aging changes, and one mustn't become frightened or panicked about them. Ordinary aging does not affect long-term memory. It doesn't affect this great big reservoir that we have of experience and thinking about those experiences, reflecting on them, creating what some of us like to think of as wisdom.
And of course, the problem with memory loss is the terrifying prospect of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, exactly. About 11% of people over the age of, let's say, mid-60s will develop Alzheimer's, but there are very specific symptoms that give Alzheimer's away, and that still leaves 89% of people who will not be afflicted by such a dreadful thing.
And I was fascinated by a statistic that you list in your book that the numbers of people in nursing homes is actually fairly small. You admit that there are probably just as many people having the same kinds of problems in their own homes, but nevertheless, this is not an inevitable prospect for most Americans.
Well, not one, but the most important factor that determines whether someone can live at home or has to be in a nursing home is not any named disease, but simply physical frailty, that the musculoskeletal system has so deteriorated that people can't get around in their own homes. And the most interesting thing about that is that it's changeable. And geriatricians love to do this experiment over and over again of taking people in their mid-80s and subjecting them to a program of vigorous weight training. And the result is always the same. Within 6 weeks, an 85-year-old can double his or her strength and make themselves independent.
Vigorous exercise is one of the three linchpins that you suggest as part of your prescription for aging well.
Absolutely. The other two are equally important, but nothing avails if you haven't kept your musculoskeletal system in some kind of shape so that you can get around and do the things that are interesting and be with the kinds of people that you would like to be spending time with because it's so emotionally and spiritually valuable to you.
And spending time with those people, that's another part of the triad.
There it is. In the book, I tell the story of having one of my many bull sessions with the chief of geriatrics at Yale and talking about musculoskeletal performance and how I go to the gym 3 times a week and pump iron. He said, yeah, but you know, that's not the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail is interrelationships with other people whom you value, being needed in the lives of other people. The way I like to put it is looking into the eyes of someone else and seeing yourself reflected there as a person of value.
I remember listening to you talk with Robert Siegel the other day on All Things Considered. The formula was, if it's a choice between going to the gym or playing with your grandchildren, go see the grandkids.
I'm all for that. And if you don't have grandchildren, my God, there are friends, there are community groups we can belong to. And the significant factor is being part of something that in some sense depends on your being there, being needed, having that sense that one or other people really depend on you for something.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on this conversation. We're speaking with Dr. Sherwin Newland, whose most recent book is The Art of Aging, A Doctor's Prescription for Well-Being. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Gary. Gary with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi, Dr. Newland. Thank you for your research. I just wanted to ask you, I make my living as a horseshoer, and a few years ago I dissected a young horse's foot and saw the changes that came about from incorrect horseshoeing and how the bones actually changed. And it got me to thinking about my own arthritis in my spine. And I thought, if I can eat well and practice yoga and get the muscular structure correct, can I correct the arthritic changes in my spine? And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't know if you can correct the bony changes, but I'll tell you what you can correct. You can correct the muscular changes that are secondary to splinting in one form or another to save your bones. One of the interesting experiences that I had personally was after I started going to the gym about 8 years ago, somewhere about year two, I began to notice that all those little cricks in my neck and in my back had virtually disappeared. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but the most important reason is that we can increase our strength very easily just by these resistance exercises. And it isn't so much increasing the amount of muscle as it is increasing the neurological coordination of all of those fibers. So they work better together, and they're much less likely to put undue stress on the bones and cause the kinds of difficulties in the spine, for example, or shoulders that elderly people are more likely to have.
Gary, I have to ask you, is there a lot of work for horseshoers in Berkeley?
You know, Michael, it's a question everyone asks, and most of the work is in Contra Costa County, and frankly, there are more horses in Contra Costa than there are people.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it, and good luck.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for everything.
So long. Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Roger. Roger, all calling from the other side of the bay in San Francisco.
Yes, thank you, Neil. Doctor, I retired very early, 47. I'll be 68 in July. next month we're leaving for Europe on a vacation. I've done this for years. What I've learned about aging is moderation. Everything should be done in moderation. Don't throw your whole life into golf. Don't throw your whole life into stamp collecting. But do just a little bit of everything. One of the things I find so satisfying is simply talking to nation, not only listening to it, but occasionally participating on it. It keeps your mind alert. It's certainly not an easy thing to do. Public speaking is one of the most fearful things a person can do, but it's energizing.
Yeah, where's that research on Talk of the Nation participation, Dr. Newland?
Well, it's implicit between the lines of the book, Neil. I love the notion of moderation because, as you know, I put about 7 or 8 profiles of people who have, well, the term is successfully aged, and one of them is Michael DeBakey, the great cardiac surgeon, who uses the term to draw in one's horizons, to try to look at the things that you get the most emotional reward out of, the things that you've always wanted to do, but you've frittered your energies away in different directions, things that you might be best at, for example. And this is essentially moderation. The Greeks used that wonderful term, the golden mean. And we've got to be so careful about that now as far as energizing is concerned. This is another DeBakey notion, his notion that of looking forward to something that will be interesting to you. It's the anticipation of interest that makes such a difference to older people, whether it's the thought that, oh my gosh, next week there'll be an interesting topic on Talk of the Nation and I can do that.
Roger, thanks very much for the kind words and have a great time on your vacation.
Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate the call. We're going to talk. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about The Art of Aging, Sherwin Newland's latest book, and it appears his own philosophy on getting older. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In his new book, Dr. Sherwin Newland offers up a prescription for well-being. Don't worry about living forever, he argues. Stay active, eat well, have some fun while you're here. You can read more of what he has to say at our website. We've posted an excerpt from The Art of Aging, a Doctor's Prescription for Well-Being at npr.org/talk. And Sherwin Newland is our guest today. We ask all of you, boomers in particular, is aging a sentence or an opportunity? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And one of the things you write about, Dr. Newland, is this expectation that somehow we're at the mercy of the tyranny of the decades, that even though the last morning of our 59th year is not a whole lot different from the first morning of our 60th, there's this perception that we have that something fundamental has changed.
Well, that's right. How old would we feel if we didn't know how old we are? Age has this way of slowly creeping up on us, and most people don't realize they're becoming what's called elderly until, well, in my case, a student said, Dr. Newland, do you use email? And that was my first clue that maybe I was looking to him older than I was looking to myself. There comes a time when you begin to realize your body isn't doing the kinds of things that you were used to. But the interesting thing about that time is that very often your creative juices, your emotional juices, maybe your spiritual juices are flowing more than ever. And one of the reasons for that is that one's occupation or one's profession is not one's identity. And you get a little older, you get into your 50s and your 60s, and you start thinking about all the things I've wanted to do that now I can do instead of being a lawyer or an engineer or a school teacher or whatever. And I can express much more of what's in my personality and then seek out new ways of doing that.
You also point out that we should also act our age, and maybe if one of those goals was to play second base for the New York Yankees, you might want to put that goal aside.
You might not want to do that. There's this wonderful poem by Browning that everybody knows, "Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be." And somewhere in there he says, "Look not thou down, but up." Well, you better look down. Because the fact of the matter is, as I reiterate again and again in the book, there are a number of things that indeed do go wrong, no matter how well we take care of ourselves. And we've got to be very careful because we want to make the maximum out of what we have and what our potentiality is.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Doug, who's calling on our international line from Germany.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
I'm calling somebody because I was fascinated with your comments about activity as far as muscle training.
Yes.
And I have a living example. My father will be 98 in April. 10 years ago, he started doing some muscle training because of an article I sent him, read in the paper. And he lives in Philadelphia, by the way, in that area in the States. And he started doing then 3-day-a-week workouts with Nautilus equipment and bicycle. And walking 1.5 miles a day or whatever, and not, you know, just part of his normal way of life. And he recently sustained, unfortunately, a broken bones in his back as a result of a fall. He was paying too much attention to his lady friend going downstairs and missed him. And as a result, though, his recovery has been amazing, even at that age.
I'm so glad.
It'll take a longer time to get back, but you know he's it's only because of the muscles that are built up that he's much more resistant to those types of injuries that affect older people and really, you know, cause them to end up in wheelchairs.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Doug, because that's one of the most important things about increasing your muscular strength. We have these preconceptions, these images of the fact older people cannot build their strength up, and all of these experiments that show that people in their mid-80s can double their strength within 6 weeks, and the major virtue of that is not only being stronger, but being able to recover from these kinds of injuries more quickly. When older people who have been doing weight training fall, they're more likely to be able to control the fall that they have. So we've got to throw out these old preconceptions that we've all grown up with. That's where we're counting on the boomers.
Exactly. Well, I don't want to waste any more time on the show, but I just want to say he's a living example, and I can only say to everybody else, getting in that age or even before that, start sooner and just do a regular workout, and that'll help going forward.
Well, there it is. Largely what we are in our 80s is a trajectory, continuation of a trajectory of what we started in our 40s. But it's never too late. It's a good thing to begin early, but you can begin when
you're in your 90s. The last thing I would say is he's a Yale graduate.
Well, we'll try not to
hold
that against him.
Unfortunately, the opposite end of the thing is that his class, there's too few people there for a reunion, so he ends up going to George Bush the First reunions.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that specifically because there's this huge study that was done on students from the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard over a 50-year period, and it turns out that people who have used, and the exact figure is 2,000 calories per week, more than their classmates, can postpone disability by an average of 7 years. And one of the secondary importances of that is that you realize that nature is less important than nurture as we get older. So this crosses all DNAs, everybody's genetic predisposition, and yet they do better if they do this kind of exercise.
I was afraid you were going to say the study of all these people at Penn and Harvard that turned out that they had really wanted to go to Yale. Doug,
I just my father's DNA is in me. I'll let you go. Other people want to call, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call, Doug. Here's an email we got from Jean in Madison, Alabama. And the current outrage of the hour is the mugging of a centenarian in New York City. I was very impressed to see a lady who was not bound to a wheelchair, as I typically see on the news, but a lady living independently and actively. And I was left wondering how she accomplished this. This is the lady who fought back against her mugger.
Yes, I actually saw those videos, and the remarkable thing about the videos was that they were taken just a few hours later, and she didn't seem to be badly injured. And I'm going to guess, without knowing, that this woman pursued a very vigorous life, that she had just come in from shopping, for example. How many 101-year-old people do you know do their own shopping? So it was a question of body and mind at the same time. How articulate she was in describing what happened to her.
Here's an email from Ted in Oakland, California. Hopefully you can take some time in your program to talk about efforts to extend our lives. Aging is a disease which can be cured, he says.
Well, every species, of course, has its own species-determined life expectancy. Ours is probably about 120 years old. In the book, there's a chapter about a couple of days I spent at the University of Cambridge with a molecular biologist who has determined that he has figured out why cells age. There are seven reasons, and he's got a response to every reason. And if he gets $100 million, why, he'll have us living 5,000 years, and during that time there'll be more research, so it'll be 10,000 years. And this brings up the whole issue of should we be attempting to extend life beyond the normal species-determined level, or should we be spending most of our time, most of our effort, most of our money on what the geriatricians call compression of morbidity, making the years that we have up to 120, hopefully, as good and strong and rewarding as possible. Geriatricians are attempting to extend our length of life within the normal species determination, but to make those years so good that instead of slowly declining and getting sicker and sicker over 10 or 15 years, that decline happens in the last couple of years, and the rest of it up until then is vigorous, rewarding, and fun.
And this email question from M. Michael in Burlington, Massachusetts. What about caloric restriction? It seems to do well for mice, and some of us really hate exercise.
Caloric restriction has been shown repeatedly in mice to increase lifespan perhaps by as much as a third. The problem with all of this kind of thing is that if you try it with human beings, it's virtually impossible to follow. Actually, I recently saw a video with a couple who had calorically restricted for 3 years. It wasn't just that they were skinny and listless, but they found it necessary to let everybody know how vigorous they were when clearly they were not vigorous. This is an awful way to spend your life. But I do recommend caloric restriction within reason. Michael DeBakey, who is, you know, he's in his 90s, I'm sorry, he's 97 years old. When I had dinner with him or lunch with him, he ate about a third what I did. We should eat for hunger and not for appetite. That makes a big difference.
Easier said than done.
Yes, yes, yes.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Claudia. Claudia with us from Denver, Colorado.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. And
sure.
Dr. Newland, I have enjoyed so many of your books. So
oh,
it's
thanks
a pleasure
so much
to get to speak to you. I have a chronic disease. I'm 59 years old, and I was diagnosed at about the age of 47 with multiple sclerosis. And I actually had onset of symptoms beginning about 2 years prior to that. And I had always been an extremely active person, watched my diet, walked 35 miles a week, did aerobics, did yoga, did qigong, I mean, you know, the whole gamut, weightlifting. And at this point, I am in a wheelchair. I have virtually no use of my legs. I do try to do upper body exercises on a regular basis. And I think your philosophy is wonderful, but what do you do with somebody such as I?
Well, you know, one of the things I did in the book was deliberately seek out people who had taken some very hard hits.
I immediately think of Patricia Neal in this case.
Exactly. 39 years old, had a massive stroke. The newspapers reported that she had died. And, of course, she's got considerable disability from all of this kind of thing. And what I discovered talking to people who had been hit as hard as you have, Claudia, is that it wasn't so much the disease they had or the tragedy in their own lives, but the response to it. And, of course, our lives are cut short by dreadful problems like multiple sclerosis and others. But, again, you know people with multiple sclerosis who don't have the outlook on life that makes you, for example, say, gee, I've been reading your books and I like your books, or calling in to Talk of the Nation. There, you're telling us essentially that your vitality, your intellectual vitality, your interest in life has remained just what it would be if you were perfectly healthy, and yet you've got this dreadful problem to live with. So there are factors that may not be very good physically, but nevertheless spiritually and emotionally may even enrich us, even though we've got those problems that are changing the course of our lives and the length of our lives.
And I'm not concerned about the length of my life. I just, what the problem is that I would like so much, and I do volunteer work for a number of organizations and that kind of thing, and I do read as much as I can, although that's become very difficult. It used to be a passion, but now I have a great deal of problem with my eyes, again, caused by the MS. And, you know, I try to focus on the quality and stay engaged with everything that's going on around me.
Sounds like that pretty well fits the prescription.
Yeah.
That is the prescription. I think it was Montaigne who said it's not the length of the candle, it's how brightly it glows.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Claudia, good luck to you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
We're talking with Dr. Sherwin Newland about his most recent book, The Art of Aging, A Doctor's Prescription for Well-Being. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get Richard on the line. Richard with us from Maricopa in Arizona.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Richard.
For your guest, I wish that he would please comment. I'm 65 years old. My wife is 10 years younger than myself. And she's a disciple of Diane Sommers' most recent books on hormone therapy. And Diane Sommers addresses men, hormone therapy for men as well as women. And my wife is constantly prescribing to me from the material that she's absorbing. And I'll take your comments off the phone and on the air.
Okay, Richard. Thanks very much.
Well, this is a problem. For example, I'm assuming that the hormone therapy she's referring to is something of a testosterone derivative. It's scary. It's dangerous. We know that the frequency of men who eventually develop the very common disease of prostatic cancer is sufficiently increased that most doctors with experience, with knowledge, would not recommend that kind of hormone therapy for men. We have no idea of the long-range effects of steroids, other hormones, in men. It's an absolutely blind area. It frightens me. I don't take any at all. And considering the fact that statistically 60% of men in their 60s have microscopic prostatic cancer that never manifests itself, I don't think it's a good idea to run the risk of activating that kind of microscopic change with any hormone therapy whatsoever. And growth hormone is in the same category as far as I'm concerned.
This comes under the category of, without meaning insult to anybody, but panaceas.
Panacea is an artificial enhancement. Nothing in this book talks about artificial enhancements because I'm not a great believer. I'm a great believer in the enhancements that we produce by our physical activity, by our mental creativity, and most importantly, I think, by the kinds of relationships we have with people, by the sense of being part of a community, by being needed by others.
Here's an email we got from Michelle. In my 40s, hit by a truck while on my bike, two broken legs, healed with a deformity, developed Graves, developed advanced esophagitis and fructose intolerance, and finally IBS. I will take my wrinkles and flab any day. I walk 10,000 steps every day, average 20,000 on the weekend. I work out every other night with weights and do sit-ups. I'm determined to feel good day by day. When afflictions happen before the aging process sets in, then believe me when I say my age-related aches and pains are a welcome change change to my other problems. I'm proud of fighting every day to feel good, and sometimes I even succeed. I may be slower at my tennis game, and my time for walking a mile is slower than it was, but I enjoy the challenge of aging, and I like the way my face is showing my life's experiences. We'll have more with Dr. Sherwin Nuland when we come back from a short break. It's the Talk of the Nation. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. You're listening to NPR News. Right now, though, we're talking with Dr. Sherwin Nuland about his new book, The Art of Aging. You can read an excerpt at npr.org/talk. And let's get another caller on the line. Catherine is with us. Catherine calling from San Francisco.
Hi. I agree with everything you're saying about keeping physically and mentally fit. I started working out in my 30s, and then I started riding motorcycles when I was 50. I'm 58 now. I ride a Harley. And I also finally got my degree, my BFA from the San Francisco Art Institute, and now I'm working on my master's. So, yeah, life goes on.
And how's the riding going, Catherine?
Oh, I did crash once, and the ground is really, really hard. But I bounced right back, and it's something that I really, really want to be able to do.
And your master's, what are you studying?
Painting.
Painting. Dr. Nuland.
Yes, painting. Well, first, let me say that what we are in our 70s and 80s is the trajectory we started in our 30s and 40s. And this is why I aim so much of this book at the boomers. And once again, it's never too late to start. But the trick is really to begin early so that you are a person who is just accustomed to thinking of life and thinking of one's body in this particular way. I'm fascinated by the painting, Catherine, because in the book I tell this story of visiting Home for the Elderly. 2,000 people were there outside of Paris in one of those little villages. They're always called things like Colombe de Saint-Église-Mémérie or something like that. And being introduced to the director of psychology, who, when he first got there, I believe it was 15 years ago, invited a number of Parisian artists to come in and teach painting to the people who lived there, most of whom, almost all of whom, had never painted before. 15 years, he had a collection of 40,000 paintings because he had convinced the administration to create little studios. So if you wanted to wake up at 3 in the morning, you had a key to your studio and you could work on your painting. And I saw a few hundred of them. And I must tell you, it brought home to me the importance of what this man, René Laforestre, was talking about, which was creativity. Creativity becomes such an important thing as we get older. The notion that you're learning something new and every day you're a little bit better than the way you were before. And it gets back to this other notion of the anticipation of something interesting tomorrow.
Oh boy, that's true. I'm looking forward to my MFA, and I'm also studying Italian. And when I graduate, I hope to be able to take classes over there. But now you just gave me a great idea about helping the elderly. Of course, I'll be elderly too, but helping the elderly in Italy, that'll be fun.
Well, that's right. This isn't make work. You know, it isn't a little artistic stuff. It's serious work teaching people to paint.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get Mel on the line. Mel's with us. It seems to be on I-94 between Chicago and Detroit.
Hello, Dr. Nuland. I'm happy to speak with you.
And turn down your radio, please.
Yes. My wife and I are driving to visit my mother, whose 101st birthday is tomorrow. She lives by herself. She has aides coming in several mornings a week. There is no hint of dementia in her, but she is woolly, she is a little forgetful, and far more literal-minded than she used to be, lost the capacity to metaphorize, I guess. My question is, what is reasonable to expect? I would assume that if there's no dementia that has appeared so far is unlikely to be. She used to be a piano teacher and still plays every day and keeps herself occupied with crossword puzzles and little manual projects and can carry on a terrific conversation for a while. But as I said, she is forgetful and is just far more literal and somewhat nervous. And I guess what can I expect?
Well, in the first place, forgetfulness, you know, is not pathological. It's a normal aging change. And one of the things I do in the book is differentiate between what normal aging changes are and what the things are that we have to worry about. We've discovered, and this is fairly recent, the last 5 or 10 years, that the brain determines its own aging. The strength of the synapses, the connections between brain cells, the amount of neurotransmitter, the liquid, we'll call it a liquid chemical, that carries the messages from one nerve cell to another, the amount of blood supply is actually determined by how much we use our brains.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing you said, sir.
I say that all of these factors, the strength of the transmission of the nerve impulses in the brain, even the blood supply to the brain, even the creation of new cells, because stem cells create new cells in the brain. We never knew that till 5 or 10 years ago. These are determined completely by how much we use our brains. The brain is essentially plastic in the sense of changeable. And if you don't use it, well, there's Ann Landers. You lose it.
Mel, drive carefully and have a good time with your mom.
Thank you very much.
So long. Here's an email from Helen in Casper, Wyoming. Could your guest please talk about massage and the effect it has on fighting stress tearing away at the body over time?
Well, my sense of massage really is that it's something emotional and psychological. Our state of mind, our feeling of well-being becomes a determinant of how much we actually do to increase the well-being. The person who has a sense of vibrancy about oneself is the person who is more likely to exercise, the person who's more likely to go to a museum and tax their intellect or decide, oh my God, I've always wanted to read Dickens. Let me read 10 of them in a row. So I'm all for anything whatsoever that makes one feel better about one's state of corporeal, if I can use that word, vitality.
There's also, you mentioned this in passing earlier, the nature-nurture element of this. To what degree, to benefit from any of this prescription, must we be winners of the genetic lottery?
Well, of course it helps to win the genetic lottery, but biology is not destiny. We've known that for a long time, and there's no question that as we get older, how you've maintained the machinery is much more important than the machinery you were granted in the first place. We older people have to become what I call philosophers of aging. We don't get as many second chances as we did when we were 30 or 40 or 50, so it behooves us to do the things that keep heart, muscle, brain in good condition, whether or not we're endowed by our DNA.
So a properly maintained Yugo will do just as well as perhaps a Mercedes that's been left neglected.
Well, the proof of all of this is these huge studies of men, the Penn and Harvard one, for example, where it makes no difference what genetic background is. If you do a certain amount of exercise, your lifespan will be increased, your vibrancy and strength will be increased, and the most important thing, once again, is this is not genetic. This is something you've done for yourself.
Let's see if we can wind up a last call. Bob. Bob's with us from Cleveland, Georgia.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
I'm a World War II veteran who got shot at by the Koreans before they actually started the war. I've been lucky is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And I got very much more lucky than I'd been all my life when I came to Georgia in 1973. Met a guy who said he believed in holistic medicine rather than chemical warfare, put me on to vitamin C, which I've discovered helps my entire body. I don't ache in any joint anymore. I'm now 78, so that's, you know, better than average, I believe. My reflexes are as good as any teenager's, and this year I'm going to try for the land speed record in Bonneville. I've been racing sports cars 50 years come this month, actually.
Well, good luck with that, Bob.
And the object is I exercise, I take my vitamins, and I have no problems. My medical doctor says I have a benign history. That's what he wrote in the medical check I just, you know, just completed because my racing driver's license was up for renewal.
Well, you're doing all the right things. I have to confess I'm hooked on vitamin C myself. I discovered it when I was working.
You don't have colds. You don't have all sorts of maladies that everybody else gets.
Mm-hmm. There it is. I never have colds. As soon as I get a little bit of a cold, I start pouring the vitamin C down my throat.
Right, that's good. And it also, I had a damaged a knee in 1984, discovered that the vitamin C, taken in large quantities, turned out to be about 3,000 milligrams a day, kept the joint from hurting. And to this day, it does not hurt if I take the vitamin C, and it does if I don't.
Well, you may meet some doctors who tell you not to go above 2,000, but it seems to work for you, so
no,
don't do a thing differently.
And Bob, maybe it's that need for speed that keeps everything working properly.
Well, it must be, because that helps. And my crew chief in our Bonneville effort says, whatever you're doing, keep on doing it.
You bet, Bob. Congratulations, and get the record and call us back, okay?
But everything that this man is talking about is part of my regime. That's what I'm getting at, really.
All right.
Everything he's recommended is in addition to what I'm doing.
Okay, thanks very much for the call, and again, good luck to you.
Okay.
And Dr. Newland, thank you for your time today.
Oh, what a pleasure.
Sherwin Newland is the author of, most recently, The Art of Aging, a Doctor's Prescription for Well-Being. He joins us today from our bureau in Chicago. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.